Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, July 11th, 1998. In the Creekside Room this evening is Cheryl Ney. Today's session number is 98-5, and it is titled Connecting with Connected Scientists, Past, Present, and Future. Let's listen in.
In this session, although I don't think there's anyone hard of hearing in the room, but we've been asked to do that this week. Flash the lights, because this week there'll be some campers who are hard of hearing, and it reminds them to flash the lights. There we go. Now, roll the tape. Okay. Tonight's session is Connecting with Connected Scientists, Past, Present, and Future. And my name is Cheryl Ney. I'm a biochemist at Capital University in Columbus, Ohio. Because this is Saturday night, we wanted to try to combine some heavy-duty ideas with some lightheartedness. So we're going to start out with a question that will define what we mean here by connected scientists. But we get to do it using some humor. And so I have a clip from Saturday Night Live that I'd like to show you. And I'd like for you to watch it in two ways. One, I want you to feel free to laugh, all right? So there's no political correctness police around here at all. And you're completely free to laugh at anything you find funny in this clip, okay? The other way I'd like you to watch it is really sort of as an anthropologist. What would an anthropologist say if they encountered this clip? What would they say about science? Right? There's a message here embedded in Saturday Night Live's humor about science, and so we want to try to capture that while we have some fun. All right. So the tape will really help us answer the question, what is not this thing called connected science? And I think that's all I'll say about it. So let's put the Saturday Night Live tape in first. Would you mind hitting the lights back there? Both switches. So be an anthropologist and also have a chuckle.
Charlie the gerbil out of his cage and put him in the box here. He's a risky little. You got him?
Yeah.
Okay, excellent. Okay, Tommy, you can turn on the vacuum cleaner now.
No.
Is the air pressure inside the vacuum cleaner greater or less than the air pressure outside the vacuum? Becky?
It's greater.
Tommy?
Less.
So Becky, you say the air pressure is...
greater.
And Tommy, you say the air pressure is...
less.
Now think about this, Becky. The gerbil moved into the vacuum cleaner, which means the air pressure inside is...
less.
Less, that's correct. So Tommy, that means you are smart. No, you're right. And that means Becky is...
wrong.
That's right. Now why is Becky wrong?
Because she didn't understand that.
No.
Because she didn't know about...
No, Becky is wrong because she's a girl. I'll bet you'll be able to get one of those fish out, and we'll do another little experiment with What? Air pressure.
I think I got one.
Oh.
Okay, good. All right.
Move a little more air to the
top. Well, let him go.
Whoa.
Why did he walk around like that?
Well, maybe you can tell me.
Oh, because the pressure outside the tank is lower than inside the tank?
No, he's flopping around because he can
swim?
No.
Then he can stand up?
No, he can't breathe.
Breathe.
That's right. He can't breathe.
Look, he stopped.
Oh, he looks dead.
Yes, he does. Why does he look dead? Because we talked to...
Loud?
No, we talked to...
Not God?
No, we talked to... Long. Now, what have we learned about air pressure so far? Well, we've learned that the pressure inside the vacuum is less. Tommy's right. Becky's wrong. She's a girl. This is science. The fish is dead. And we talked to Long. We talked to Long.
Gosh, Dr. Know-it-all, I never know what I'm going to learn when I come here.
Well, Becky, we're not finished. Come on over here. Do you know what this is?
Well, it's the planet of our solar system.
That's right. Tommy and I made these last week by putting paper mache over balloons.
Hey, Dr. Know-it-all, we were using air pressure.
Why, yes, we were, inside the balloons. Very good. Now, I made the four outer planets, and Tommy made these planets. Now, look at my planets. They look good. But Tommy's planets look...
small?
No, bad. The planets you made look bad. Right, Becky?
Yes.
Yes, that's right. Why? Why? Why do you think that is? Because I'm a man. That's right. So my work is much better. Okay. Now, let's move over here. Here's some balloons for you. Becky, I want you to fill these up with water. And Tommy, you take the blindfold and stand over there. Oh, I hear a theme. That means we're just about out of time. We'll have to save this experiment for another day. Okay? Okay, well, bye for now.
Television of 1986, so that's such a great clip. I don't know what I'm going to do to fix that. So if you were an anthropologist and you saw that clip, and that's all the information you have, what might you conclude about science? What would you conclude?
It's for men.
It's for men, right? We had that over and over again. The science teacher said it specifically when the case came with the girl student, Demi Moore, and it also came out at the very end again, right? When his planets were better. It was because he was the man scientist, right? All right, so one thing we'd learned by that tape is that science is done by men. What other kinds of things might we learn about science or science teaching? Yeah.
You're always wrong.
Right, the students always seem to be wrong, right? And they're kind of trying to fill in this blank, right? And they're just kind of waiting for the eye contact from the teacher to shake their head and go, yes, yes, right? So that learning science is about learning to put in the right answer, right? Okay, anything else we've learned about scientists and science education by viewing this tape? How about treatment of animals?
Inhumane.
Right? Yes. Let's just suck that gerbil into the vacuum cleaner, right? No problems whatsoever. What's that?
We'll take the fish out of the tank.
Right, right. Knowing full well that the fish is going to die without any water, right? So that's really kind of a lighthearted look at some of the downside of science as it's been traditionally practiced. So science, as we traditionally know it, is pretty male-dominated, although we're happy to say that that's changing. As it has been traditionally practiced in the past, we don't care about those animals or any object of our study. We do whatever it takes to study, right? And part of the values behind that is that, remember, that scientists want to be objective, and they want to be detached from what they're studying, because if you're detached, right? You don't want to have any empathy for that poor fish, and God knows you don't want to have any empathy for that poor gerbil, right? So the videotape kind of gives us a snapshot of science as we traditionally understand it, or in fact how it's traditionally been practiced. Let's think for a moment about our common ideas for science and the idea of objectivity and rationality. What common TV or movie character do we see who's really the supreme scientist, the most rational, most objective scientist? Who are they? Can you guys tell us? When you watch television, who are the best scientists in a drama, in a television show?
The guy?
Yeah. On Star Trek, who are the scientists?
The unfeeling one.
Right, Mr. Spock, right? The Vulcan. And on the new Star Trek series, who's the scientist?
Another Vulcan.
There's another Vulcan on. That's the third Star Trek. The second Star Trek has Data. Remember Data? Who's an android, right? And he's working really hard to try to get emotion. So sort of in our culture, our best known examples of great scientists are not even human, right? They're androids or they're Vulcans. They're not human. All right? Now, I think I should probably say very clearly that I'm not trying to condemn science, all right? I think we've gained lots from our science. What I want to try to suggest is we need to stop a minute and take a look at some of these values, and perhaps if we use some other values, we can head off in other directions, and we'll have more questions to ask and more knowledge to gain, all right? So I don't want anybody in the room to be unhappy with my characterization of traditional science. I want to say we know a lot, don't we? And we know a lot because of this science. But we also know we've got some dangers, right? It's not always good, all right? So what I want to try to suggest is if we look at some other ways, some other values that we can put in science, we might come up with a different kind of science, expand science. So what I mean then by something that is not connected science is this kind of pure rationality, this no emotion, pure detachment from what you're studying, no care or concern. In that at all, right? And so what we want to ask now as we move along here is the question, well, how did science get started anyway? How did it get started so that it had this value of being objective, right? And I want to now show a clip which is not going to be humorous. In fact, for you little ones, it might be a little difficult. But I promise you, this tape towards the end will be something more that you can understand, all right? So if you need to zone out or you need to go to the bathroom, now is a good time. Points number two and number three here are going to be a little heavy hitting. All right? So let's move on to the second point, and that is, so how did this science get started? And then we'll also look at some different values we can put in science. So we'll roll a bit of the next tape. This is an interview done by Bill Moyers. Many of you know him from, he has a series on healing, I think. Very popular.
Yes.
This is a series on the world of ideas. And so this is an interview between Bill and modern day scientist, Dr. Edna Fox Keller, who has also become a historian of science. So we'll watch a bit of this to kind of get a sense of what are the roots of science as it's currently practiced. So if you just put that in there, it'll switch to them. Yeah. It's cute. It's cute right there. You go ahead and flip
them. In the 50s, to be a scientist, she discovered it was a man's world. Not only because most scientists were men, but because the language of science itself reflected masculine metaphors and values. Why is this so, she wondered. Trained since then as a theoretical physicist, she has taught mathematics and done research in mathematical biology. But it is her work on the history of science, her book, Reflections on Gender and Science, and her biography of the geneticist Barbara McClintock, that brought me to the University of California, Berkeley, where Dr. Keller teaches in the Department of Rhetoric.
What does rhetoric have to do with science, I thought, when I first heard about it?
That is a good question. Language, I think, is the mediator of meaning values and meaning expectations into our descriptions of nature. And if we want to understand how science reflects, the ways in which science is reflecting back to us particular expectations, particular values, we have to understand, we have to look at the language of science and see how that works, how the traffic between ordinary and technical language works as a carrier, if you will, of ideology in science.
And what are your chief contributions to this has been that gender plays a significant role in the language that scientists use to describe their work.
And that's played a very, very powerful role.
And by gender, you mean, you don't mean sex, the given of nature, our biological difference, do you?
No, I mean ideas of masculinity, ideas of femininity, and that the language of sex and the language of sex and the language of gender have been extremely prominent in scientific discourse since the scientific revolution.
And the dominant image has been?
Well, Henry Oldenburg said it very clearly. The purpose of the Royal Society was to establish a truly masculine philosophy. Why? What did they mean by truly masculine philosophy? Francis Bacon said, let us establish a chaste and lawful marriage between mind and nature. The purpose of this marriage was to bind nature and bring nature and all her children to your service, bind her and make her your slave. That was the purpose of it.
Mind, husband, nature, wife. And the purpose of science was to give the mind, the husband, mastery over nature.
But the central metaphor for the scientific revolution was a marriage between mind and nature that was modeled on a particular kind of marriage, a patriarchal marriage, the purpose of which was the domination of nature, the bride, nature.
And the Royal Society of London was founded in 1662 and didn't admit a woman until 1945. That's studying the language to determine your policy for a long time.
But science had a particular commitment to the notion that there was something special about what they were doing, a special kind of thinking, a special kind of philosophy, a special kind of activity.
What was it?
That was, in the most general sense, was thinking like a man. It was thinking, it was the idea, it was committed to an ideal of objectivity that was from the beginning equated in a very curious way. The equation between objectivity and masculinity is a very curious equation. In fact, it was that equation that motivated my entire inquiry. I wanted to understand what does that mean to say thinking objectively is thinking like a man. What could it mean? Where does such an idea come from? And more important, what consequences has it had for science?
There were so many examples of these first scientists, the 300 years ago, founding modern science, who used this masculine language to assign masculine virtues to science. Your book is full of them. Which is your favorite?
The best quote I can think of is Joseph Banville. He wrote, but Jove himself cannot be wise and in love, may be understood in a larger sense than antiquity meant it. Where the will or passion hath the casting bars, the case of truth is desperate. The woman in us still prosecutes a deceit, like that begun in the garden, and our understandings are wedded to an Eve as fatal as the mother of our miseries. He concludes, if truth has no chance when the affections wear the breeches and the female rule.
He was saying that we have to exclude feeling, empathy, intuition, for the search for this, how do we work?
That's right, but he's doing it by attaching them to the female, voice. He's saying, we're excluding affection, feeling, emotion, because it's female, and we're excluding females because they bring affection, they carry with them affection. By that equation between emotion and female, he is excluding both in one move.
Whatever their motives, the consequences have been significant for science, and for all of science.
Right. Once we have shown how important, how prevalent these images of masculinity and femininity and domination were, the question remains, so what? Right. That's really the question. And it is very clear. Let me take the arguments that would be made. One person might say, yes, but that was just in the 17th century. We've left that long since behind. Well, the response to that is that we haven't left it behind. It is still with us. And I, just as an example, I grabbed I looked at my office.
So this is just for research.
Right. I just pulled out as an example a quote from C.P. Snow from the Masters in 1951. He's describing the young scientist of Duke who just had a scientific breakthrough. It's wonderful, he bursts out, when you've got a problem that is really coming out, it's like making love. Suddenly your unconscious takes control and nothing can stop you. You know that you're making old Mother Nature sit up and beg, and you say to her, I've got you, you old bitch. You've got her just where you want her.
That's 300 years after.
That's 300 years
so
after.
So what happened was that this, as a consequence of that era, there was created this ideology that mythology, that objectivity, reason, and the mind are male attributes, and subjectivity, feeling, and nature are female attributes. So what does that mean for this real time?
And that's a question that really is the kind of question that faces all of history and philosophy of science today.
We'll take a little break. It's heavy hitting stuff. Why don't we take a minute to try to chew on some of this? And really, what I want you to try to grab hold of, what about Dr. Foxkeller's research about 300 years ago about how science started? What is one thing that you caught hold of in the video? All right, so why don't you take a minute to maybe turn to somebody around you and just try to chew on all of that just a little bit. Okay? Just take a minute to chew on
what you were saying.
It was difficult, wasn't it?
Because
it
was
Sometimes that happens, yeah. But it,
I don't know.
It's kind of, it's another realm. It can take the resources and demonstrate it, for example.
But the statement
is school systems.
Yeah,
school system. Without
all right, let's play for just a moment. Let's cut in for just a moment. So what do you think some of the things that she found about the roots of modern science? What kind of things did she find?
They're not based on fact.
There are ideas of science, you mean?
Right. Not that science isn't true, but the way we've been told to think is not based on fact. Was based more on society and goals in a system.
Right. Of course, 300 years ago was a very different time. It was a time in which biologically men and women were assigned different roles in society. That back then, all the way into really the turn of our century, all the way up through that time, it was a time when it was thought that men were biologically made to think, and women were biologically made to reproduce, and therefore they couldn't use any energy to think. They had to save all their energy for reproduction. And so because of their role in childbearing, then women were assigned the role of having emotion. Right? And so as what Dr. Foxkeller's research has shown is that when you go back to the writings, what you find out is that science was founded to be a masculine philosophy, and therefore thinking objectively, as she says so nicely, was equated with thinking like a man. And in making that equation, what happened to women doing science?
They didn't.
Right? And what happened to the role of emotion?
There is none.
All right. And so that's where we find in the roots of modern science this equation between rationality, objectivity on the one hand being male, and lack of emotion when you do this work being assigned to female.
Vanity and dominance aren't emotions?
Yeah, right, isn't it? It's sort of ironic. They say they're not going to have any emotion, but yeah, that's nice. That's very nice. Other comments?
I got not a comment, but a question.
Sure.
In this, 300 years ago, what women were in science 300 years ago, in the 1600s? I can't think of it.
It turns out that all along women have been practicing various forms of science, but we don't know about them.
Oh, you mean like baking a cake?
In ancient Egypt, women were in the perfume business. They were the ones who were working on distillery and stuff like that, you know? That because of this kind of research, we've gone back and looked at history now, and lo and behold, women were there all along. There just weren't very many of them. I read an interesting one way, way back about Pythagoras. Remember Pythagoras? Yeah. What do we know him for? What subject do we know about Pythagoras? Mathematics, right?
Yeah.
Guess what? Pythagoras had a mom. Pythagoras had a mother.
Wow.
And she taught him mathematics.
Means you showed him those theorems, so he took it.
Well, she gave him a grounding in mathematics.
Oh.
So, you know, so what's sort of phenomenal about that is that A, we think about Pythagoras' mom, and B, she was the one who, when he was young, taught him mathematics.
1 + 1 = 2.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. You had a comment, Dr.?
Well, yeah, I'm trying to discern how this is different from the roots of music, or the roots of literature, or the roots of art, or the roots of history, or the roots of political science.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Now, once we make that equation,
Well, science is being singled out here
because
of what we're talking about.
Right.
But how is that any different?
Probably not at all.
Right.
Probably not different yet.
Unless you look into the extension of where it sits today, that many women in science still feel excluded on all kinds of different levels.
And in music, and in literature.
I think some fields are making more progress than other fields today. But I think you're making a very, very valid point based on what I know by talking to women in these other disciplines in the industry. So thanks for adding that point. Yeah.
Just a thought that came to my mind.
Yeah.
Another irony, though, in at least in how it's depicted, you know, maybe in the media or whatever, but who've been teachers? Maybe, I don't know how it divided out, but, you know, oftentimes, you know, you go to school in the Old West, who are the teachers? Women were the teachers.
And
it was depicted that way. I don't know if that's accurate or not, but, you know, that's almost like you were saying that Pythagoras may have learned a thing or two from his mother. Well,
it's another story about the history of women in science, that some of them were teaching science, but some of them weren't. And in fact, in the United States, our history of women in science comes from women teaching science. That's where our history of women in science comes.
We can even relate back to the church, when women couldn't be pastors, couldn't even vote in many churches or make any decisions, but they taught the Sunday school and they taught the faith.
Exactly.
You know, so,
yeah.
All along we know we've been superior, but
we're at least thinking beings anyway, right? Whether or not that thinking is always superior. All right, so now the question is, what would happen if we would try science and acknowledge that we use emotion as we think? Because we can't separate emotion from our thinking. So what happens to science when we begin to be explicit about that emotion? All right, so, you know, if you want to go off and practice science in this way, where you try to be without emotion and to be detached, good, I encourage you to do that. Lots of science has been gained in that way. My point is, let's shift the focus and see if we can't get other ways to practice science, and we can't get other equally valid, equally rich knowledge about our world, right? So what would that science look like? And that would be what I'm calling connected science. All right, so let's now go back to Dr. Keller here and have her tell us what we mean by this idea of connected science. And I have to say, I'm using the tape here because she is so eloquent, and you can, her spirit just comes forth, I think, in her speaking. So we'll get a sense of what she thinks about this different kind of science. And the question that Bill Moyers has just posed to her on the tape, I hope, is, do we miss certain things about the world because science has been gendered masculine? All right, so in other words, he's really asking her, you know, what do we get when we have this gendered kind of science, and what would we get if we practice science in a different way? So hopefully that's the answer she's going to give right here. Thank you.
To see how the values will help guide the kind of questioning one can.
But you're not arguing, are you, that if there were more women in science, we'd be studying acid rain instead of salt?
No, no. I wish that was true. I wish all we had to do was to bring more women in science. If we're bringing more women in science, into science now, and then it would change here. You know. But no, it's much more complicated because these social, ideological patterns get imprinted onto the very structure of science. It's a, there's a momentum to the development of science. You don't just come in and change it with these, you don't come into science with a different language before you don't come into science. I think that's the first
thing.
You will leave very soon. So the first point is that in order to enter into this world, you have to become re-socialized. So whether you you may have had a different language or a different set of expectations or a different set of interests because you were socialized as a woman or because you were socialized as a working class, a black, or whether you were socialized as and you grew up in Japan or China. It doesn't matter. When you enter into the world of sciences, if you want to be a member of this world, you have to learn its language. You have to learn the language of that world. So that's the first point. And the second point is that the language and the goals and the endeavor have a dynamic of its own. If it is the case, as I believe, if it is the case that the language of science shapes the actual content of science, how we employ this wonderful human endeavor, this wonderful human talent, then I think that is far more important than the question of women in science. The question of women in science is important. I don't want to say it's not important. But there are more, given the tremendous role that science plays in the world we live in, the idea that science could be redirected, that there could be changes in the way in which science is done and the way in which it moves, the direction in which it moves, that seems to me of even greater importance. That's my principal argument. And my principal case, my strongest case for that argument is the story of Barbara McClintock. I titled my biography of McClintock, A Feeling for the Organism. It wasn't for my agenda that I chose that title. The title was hers. It's her deepest belief that you cannot do good research without a feeling for the organism. A feeling for the organism was her refrain.
So what do you mean, Dr. Keller, a feeling for the organism?
I mean the ability to identify with the subject of study, to feel kinship with the study the subject that you're studying, instead of feeling engaged in a battle, in a struggle, in a state of opposition.
Do you really feel that's primarily a female mode of approaching science?
No. I believe that it's been called a female mode of approaching science. I believe it is a human virtue, a human talent. We're talking about empathy, the capacity for empathy. I don't think that women have a corner in the market of empathy. I think that all of us are capable of empathy, although I do think that it's not a talent that is very, very well developed in many men because of the ways in which they're raised. But it is precisely because it has been identified as a feminine virtue, as a feminine talent, that it has been excluded from science.
Can you give me some specific examples? I mean, I can think of some very obvious ones. I think of the first atomic bomb was called Fat Boy. And it was delivered from the womb of a bomber named Enola Gay, a female delivering the weapon of destruction. But that's probably too extreme.
sort of takes us off with a deeper discussion. So, really the key word out of that is that a connected science is a science done with empathy, and I think she really handles the question nicely, can only women be empathetic? Right? I think she says really beautifully that it is a human virtue, a human quality, and that it's just a matter of socialization of who ends up feeling this empathy for organisms. So my notion of connected science is a science practiced with empathy towards your object of study rather than this detached, dispassionate observer stance.
Did Barbara McClintock do corn genetics?
She did. She did. And I'm going to we'll talk about her in just a second. I just want to give you a beautiful example of experiencing science with empathy that we discovered this week at Holden. I'm a chemist, so all week long we've been talking about doing chemistry with empathy. And we had a chemist in the room, a pharmaceutical chemist from Seattle, Bob Reinhardt. I have to give his name because he had such a lovely insight this week. And it goes in the following way. Think about your chemical world. Think about that bread that's baked over here at Holden. Now, a traditional science could objectively study that bread, right? He says, let's try to have some empathy and get closer attached with that bread, he says. Now think, when you smell that bread, chemically, what's going on? A molecule involved in that bread breaking process has reached your nose, and that bread now has become part of you because that bread molecule is in your nose receptor molecule. Right? That's a really different way of looking at the world, right? A really different way of looking at the world. Sort of a negative example of that is think about that mosquito bite. What did that mosquito carry away with it? Carried away a part of you. Right? So this is a way of having empathy with your chemistry and your environment. All right, so the possibilities are rich, as she suggests, because now we get different questions. When we get different questions, we get a different set of answers, a different kind of knowledge that we had before that will broaden the knowledge that we already have. All right, so, oh yeah, okay, Cheryl's got this idea about connected science. Isn't that lovely? All right, isn't that lovely? Well, I want to say that we already have a prominent example of a scientist who lived out this value in her work, all right? And that is a Nobel-winning scientist, Dr. Barbara McClintock. And for those of you who don't know about her, she did her work in the 30s and 40s, didn't get her Nobel Prize till the late 80s. Mm. All right, and that's part of the reason was she was coming from such a different direction in terms of this value of empathy that the scientific community had a really tough time in catching on to. So because we already have an example of this, let's look at her life and let's verify that you can get good information about porn, the object of her study, when you study with empathy. All right, so we don't even have to waste time with the question, is it going to be effective? We know it's going to be an effective way to work because we have her life and work as an example. So we'll end tonight by looking at the story of Dr. Barbara McClintock. Maybe before we start the tape, we should think about, we should connect to the women in the past that we know. And one good way to do this is let's see if we can find the person in the room who has the oldest living grandmother. Who thinks they've got the oldest living grandmother? Think about your grandmother, if she's alive, and how old is she? How old is your grandma?
87.
82?
No.
91. 81? 89. 91. It sounds like 91.
91. 91.
So she would have been born when?
1907.
All right, so that's just around the time, I think Barbara McClintock was actually born in
1915.
Yeah, a little bit later, right? So, so this is the period we're talking about, really turn of the century, all right? I don't think I'll say, I could tell you more about the historical timeline. I don't think I'll do that. I think we'll just watch the tape. I should say that midway through the tape, there's something about her science, and so I think we'll just go ahead and play it, and you know, perhaps you can grab hold of her major idea here as we watch the tape. So let's just look at this story of a connected scientist, who I want to remind you was a Nobel Prize winner. Okay, we got that? Okay.
Can we close that?
Sure.
see it. But I think that they have to focus a bit in the thinking about what is the next basic problem. They can't answer it now, but they have it in mind. And as soon as something suggests itself as to how to proceed, they are the ones that are going to proceed along that line. We are going to have, I think, many revolutions. And this is called...
Barbara McClintock was involved in many scientific revolutions before she won the Nobel Prize in Medicine in 1983. In fact, her life in many ways traced the enormous advances in biology that had taken place since the turn of the century. Her chosen field of study, genetics, wasn't much older than she was, and during her life it had changed beyond all recognition as scientists probed ever deeper into the mysteries of life. Nonetheless, Barbara McClintock had stayed in the forefront of her field, and often in advance of it. In fact, she was so far ahead of her contemporaries that for decades she had been dismissed as an eccentric, and her findings and interpretations had been rejected. She didn't allow this to deter her, but continued her research until the rest of biology at last caught up. The award of the Nobel Prize finally acknowledged her position as one of the leading scientists of the century, but it brought with it unwelcome distractions.
If you want to know the truth, I don't like what you're saying. I don't like my time taken up towards me. And I knew it would be that. So I had and at my age, it's quite a chore.
Even as a child, Barbara McClintock was encouraged to be herself, to the point of being allowed to miss school if she didn't like her teacher. This didn't seem to hurt her education. And in 1919, she enrolled at Cornell University. She wanted to join the Department of Plant Breeding and Genetics, but it was not yet a time of full equality for women, and that department was still open only to men. Barbara McClintock joined the botany department instead. She soon proved herself to be one of the best students, and certainly one of the most involved.
I was inclined to take the final, because everybody was. And I was so anxious to see the question because I knew there was nothing they were going to ask me about it. I wouldn't be able to answer. And I was just very eager to see it. So I went in and they gave out them what they call blue books, the exam books. And there you had to put your name on it after you got there. Well, I was so anxious to see what the questions were that I didn't put my name on it. I just started writing right away and enjoyed it. And I got through very fast. And then I turned it over and put my name on it. I couldn't remember. And I just couldn't dare ask anybody to Jason to put my name, so I was embarrassed and rude too. But after about 20 minutes, it finally came.
Throughout her life, Barbara McClintock always did what she wanted to do, what she knew to be right, rather than what was expected of her. At college, that included playing tennis, missing lectures to go ice skating, and in the evenings, playing banjo in a jazz band. But her work was her first priority, and one by one, those other pursuits got left behind as she was drawn deeper and deeper into the science. It was in 1921, in her junior year, that she took her first course in genetics.
Genetics at that time was a very grown subject and not totally accepted by many people. At Cornell, there was only one course for undergraduates, and that was in the Department of Plant Breeding in the Agriculture College. At the same time I was doing that, I was taking a course in chromosomes.
Those courses led her into graduate work, and she rapidly demonstrated her extraordinary ability. Her advisor had been trying for years to identify the chromosomes in a type of corn called maize. McClintock managed to do it in a very short time. Her whole field of research was blossoming, and she soon became a member of a group of the leading young researchers working on the genetics of maize. The group included George Beadle, a Nobel laureate-to-be, and Marcus Rose, who was also to become in genetics.
And we got together and began to work and talk, and then other people involved in the maize work began to join us, so we had a very, very active group working in a brand new field. So by 1931 or so, we had accomplished quite a lot.
In that year, 1931, McClintock published research which proved for the first time that the chromosomes form the basis of inheritance, one of the cornerstones of modern experimental genetics. She was celebrated as a leading light in her field, but in the 1930s, women were not easily accepted into the scientific establishment. In spite of her achievements, Barbara McClintock could not get a job. She refused to compromise by taking a teaching post and found her own ways to continue her work. After 9 years, in 1941, she was offered a junior researcher's job at the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory in Long Island, New York. She gratefully accepted it and repaid them by working there for the rest of her career. Marcus Rhodes was also at Cold Spring Harbor, and together they continued their studies of plants, in particular, maize. At that time, maize was one of the most studied organisms of classical genetics, but it had two main drawbacks. It was highly complex, and it took a long time to breed and raise each successive generation. Together, these factors made it particularly inappropriate for studying the chemical basis of heredity, and it was in this direction that genetics research was turning. In 1944, it was shown that DNA formed the material basis of inheritance. A scientific revolution followed as genetics entered the era of molecular biology. The subjects studied were bacteria and viruses, simple organisms with small amounts of genetic material and short life cycles, which meant that experiments could be performed quickly. Classical genetics techniques and disciplines were ignored, as those of biochemistry, X-ray crystallography, microbiology, and physics were adopted. In 1953, Crick and Watson unraveled the chemistry of the DNA double helix, and the central dogma was born. This maintains that the DNA controls the forms and functions of the organism. The genetic code is transcribed into RNA, and then translated into protein. The genetic information flows from the DNA to the protein, and in one direction only. The genetic material, the DNA, is the starting point and is uninfluenced by factors such as the environment. It was simple, clear, and precise. Most geneticists began to think that they had answered all of the most interesting questions. Not Barbara McClintock. She thought that most of the interesting questions hadn't even been asked yet. Using the simple techniques of observation and analysis, she was on the verge of making one of the great discoveries in modern genetics. First, she noticed unusual patches of color in maize leaves and kernels, patches of cells in which the genes that controlled color were being expressed in a way that was different from the cells around them.
I was very curious about this. This was nothing I planned on. Something was happening to change the action of the gene.
Eventually, she came to the conclusion that structural genes, the genes which code for proteins, and in this case determine the color of the kernel or leaf, could be turned on and off by other genes which lie adjacent to them on the chromosome. In the plant she was studying, the genes were turned off by a break or dissociation in the chromosome, so she called the genes which controlled this dissociators, DS. For McClintock, the dissociator gene was a controlling element. She also found that these controlling elements were themselves turned on and off by other genes which she called activators, AC, and which were situated on a completely different part of the chromosome from the dissociator and structural genes. This is where things got complicated. McClintock also discovered two more things which couldn't be explained by any of the theories then current. Firstly, the effect of the activator gene varied according to how many copies of it there were, and this could change from cell to cell. Secondly, there were other genes that were controlled by the activator, and most surprisingly, these were also controlled by the single controlling element. The only way that she could explain these findings was that pieces of DNA were moving around the genome, relocating themselves within the chromosomes. Copies of the activator gene must have been moving from chromosome to chromosome, changing its potency. And the controlling element could also change its place in the chromosome, turning any one of a number of genes on or off. McClintock called this movement transposition. This whole new system of genetic control raised another important question, as it seemed that genes could be turned on and off at precise times. How was this actually done? The only answer seemed to be that factors outside the chromosome were having some effect. that information was passing from the environment to the genetic material, from protein to DNA. This contradicted the central dogma and was heresy to the molecular geneticists who found Barbara McClintock's work both idiosyncratic and obscure.
One man I hadn't seen for a long time came in to see me, and the first thing he said, if Marcus Rose didn't tell me what you were doing, what you were doing his whole life, I wouldn't believe a word you said. Oh. And later on, somewhat later, another person I knew quite well, he used to come out here a lot, he came in to see me. And he said, no, I understand you're doing something that's very strange, and I don't want to hear a word about it. Now, these were fun. It didn't bother me one bit.
Maize, as a subject for genetics research, had long since been relegated to the history books by the molecular biologists. This meant that they were completely unfamiliar with its biology and the classical techniques that McClintock was still using. They were baffled by both her thought processes and her conclusions, even though she found them transparently obvious.
There was no question in my mind that the information I had received was so strong that there was no way of drawing any other conclusion. Therefore, when you feel that strongly about something, you can't be turned off. Nobody can hurt you. You just go right on. Nobody can hurt you. You don't even feel it.
But things were starting to change. In 1960, Jakob and Mono published their Operon theory of gene control. They had discovered that certain genes were turned on by an operator gene, which itself was turned on and off by a regulator gene. Even though this was reminiscent of McClintock's activator and controlling elements, the scientific community still didn't fully accept her findings.
When gene regulation was first announced by Jaco Monod, people were so sure that was all there was to it. That they said, if you know bacteria, you can explain an elephant. That didn't come out right in the long run. That was accepted by many people. I think we have to go through phases where you clear up one generalization and you find you have to go to another, and usually something shows what the other is going to be.
The generalizations of the central dogma were changed to include the Jakob and Mono findings, but McClintock was still out in the cold. Then it was discovered that pieces of DNA could move between bacteria, carrying antibiotic resistance with them, and that viruses worked by inserting their genetic material into that of their hosts. Slowly, transposition came to be acknowledged as a reality, and after 30 years, the scientific world caught up with Barbara McClintock. She even had a lab at Cold Spring Harbor named after her. Finally, she had triumphed over the cynics, the disbelievers, and the disadvantages of being a woman in a man's world.
It has its difficulties with respect to job offers, but otherwise very simple. In fact, I have very warm relationships with my colleagues over the years. I can tell you an experience I had with another graduate student when he was at Missouri. He was a very bright graduate student. And he was telling me one time how he couldn't stand women professors. It went on and on. And finally I stopped and I said, to whom are you talking to?
The news of the award of the Nobel Prize to Barbara McClintock was greeted with particular warmth by women around the world. Scientific research, not her gender, that won her the highest accolade in the science. She herself thought that she was too much of a maverick to be a role model for other women, but she was still conscious of her responsibilities to them.
You have to be able to understand what it means to them. That's why I'm conforming. If it weren't for that, I wouldn't conform. I wouldn't know that even want anything. Because I'm just, it's what to them. Now this has happened to me more than once with awards, no, or with recognitions that came early again that I had to stay with them, I did not, because of them, I couldn't let them down. I can't do that now.
found out that DNA moved around, and this was really heresy in her day. DNA was seen as this master molecule, and you know, when you're a master molecule, you don't change, right? You're static, right? And so it was really a remarkable theory, observation that she made. Unfortunately, this video doesn't really give you a sense of the kind of empathy she has for her organism. If you're interested in this idea of how empathy worked out in her research and led her to this finding, I encourage you to take a look at the book, A Feeling for the Organism, which, by the way, is in Holden's bookstore. And it really describes very nicely how she carries this value with her always, and that the corn, to her, is something that she has a great empathy for, and the title reflects that, right? That she says herself over and over again, I just got myself ready to listen to the corn, and when I listened to the corn told me what was going on, right? Her empathy, in the book, describes her empathy going so far as that sometimes she even hates to walk on grass, because she knows when she, you know, she walks on grass, she's stomping on grass, right? So it's a very kind of Eastern idea. We don't want to say she's the only person in the world who has this empathetic value. Anybody know offhand another great scientist who talked a lot about this kind of oneness of the universe and the importance of a scientist having this feeling of oneness? Albert Einstein. All right? So my point is that we can learn a lot when we have this value, right? So if we had more time, we could talk about how would school science change if we put in the value of empathy, right? That would be one question that we could...
What happened to the men who used her work?
I think Jacob got a Nobel Prize much earlier than she did.
They stole her work and they got a prize.
Well, they came up with a similar work and they didn't cite back to her work. She'd already discovered the idea. They used different language and they're the ones who got
their lack of is totally different than right. Transpose. I mean, I wouldn't say that in any way they stole her work.
The problem is they didn't cite her earlier work. Which, when you get right down to it, that's... all right, so we're going to talk more about her this week, we're going to talk more about empathy, and we're going to really specifically look at the case of genetics, because if we don't hurry up and get the value of empathy when it comes to genetic engineering and genetic therapy, the 21st century looks really scary. All right, I got 2 minutes to close with the idea of the theme this week is Guide Our Feet. So of the village this summer is Guide Our Feet. What does that have to do with this? Well, we've been working with the idea that whenever you're walking and you're thinking about a journey and you're walking, you can use your eyes. We often do if we're sighted. We use our eyes to guide our feet. So many when we ask for guiding our feet, we ask for guiding our eyes. But what she teaches us and what we know from our own experience is where we know more, we see more. Right? When you walk out into nature and you think about biology and molecules, you see more. So now, not only are we asking for guidance of our feet and guidance of our sight, how about guiding our minds? All right, so if we're talking about guiding our feet, we don't want to only guide our feet, we want to guide our minds. And then, if we're going to put the value of empathy in there, where else do we want guidance?
Yeah, right.
Get empathize with those red molecules, perhaps. All right? So I just encourage you to think about the idea that when we do talk about things that Holden and the idea this summer of guiding our feet, that this knowledge is good stuff. It enriches our experience. So have a great week. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We had 4 times to talk.